Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In his State of the Union address, President Obama made a pledge. By 2035, 80% of America's electricity, he said, will come from clean energy. That's the goal. Then Egypt and Tunisia rushed in and stole the spotlight, but we're still thinking about that pledge. Can we do it? Will we do it? What will it take? And how clean is the clean we've been promised? This hour on Point, we're looking ahead and thinking big about a president's energy goals with Nathan Lewis of the California Institute of Technology. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Will we make it to 80% clean power by 2035? How? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. If you can throw your mind back before the upheaval in Tunisia reached its peak, before all the tear gas in Egypt, there was that State of the Union address, and this moment, the president talking about a big clean energy goal.
Now, clean energy breakthroughs will only translate into clean energy jobs if businesses know there will be a market for what they're selling. So tonight, I challenge you to join me in setting a new goal. By 2035, 80% of America's electricity will come from clean energy sources.
There it is. Good applause, big goal. What does clean mean, and can we make it in any case? He also talked about the California Institute of Technology, Caltech, and some of their initiatives in particular. Nathan Lewis joins us now from Pasadena, California, professor of chemistry at Caltech, director of the Department of Energy's Innovation Hub there, the Joint Center for Artificial Photosynthesis, which President Obama highlighted in that State of the Union address. The center is trying to simulate photosynthesis for energy production, in essence, creating artificial leaves. Nate Lewis, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We want to step back and look at this goal. What do you make of it? 80% of electricity from clean energy, as the president defines it, by 2035.
Well, I think that, A, it's very important that we set a goal because otherwise we won't know where we're headed. So I'm all for it. I think most Americans would be for it. How can we not be for getting a lot of our energy from clean sources? How could we not be for trying to get rid of our addiction to imported oil? How could we not be for doing something that will capture the next big thing in the world in terms of energy supply and demand? So if you think of reasons to avoid doing the inevitable, none of them are compelling. I think we should go full steam ahead and go for it.
All right, then. Let's look at, is it really clean what we're talking about, and can we accomplish this goal first clean? It includes, he named, nuclear and wind and solar and new things we don't even know about, and natural gas and coal, clean coal, he described it. If those are the elements that make up our energy supply to produce electricity in 2035, will that really be clean?
Well, clean does depend on the lens through which you view the letters in the word. Some people, for instance, would say that there is no such thing as clean coal, and it depends on whether you're willing to get rid of the mercury and sulfur pollutants that come out of the stack. It also depends on if you consider the word clean to ensure that the carbon dioxide that is produced by burning coal gets safely and for a long period of time, hundreds to thousands of years, buried somewhere in the underground aquifers where it doesn't come back into the atmosphere. Through the same lens, some people would say that nuclear, by the definition of having no carbon dioxide emissions, is clean, and others are concerned about nuclear waste. Every renewable has its pluses and minuses. Hydroelectricity is great and relatively inexpensive, but there's now a trend toward, in fact, restoring rivers to their natural watersheds as opposed to damming them up. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with wind. It's clean except for the people that can hear it and can see it in the wind turbines that are installed on the landscape. What I think is important here is to realize that we are not going to get and would never want to get our energy from only one source. And so the advocates that say we're going to do it all with nuclear, we're going to do it all with fossil fuel, we're going to do it all with renewables are not really in the world that is shades of gray, and we don't live in a black and white world. We're going to need them all. We're going to need a mix. And every individual one that has its disadvantages are things we're going to have to find a way to mitigate and then do the optimization so that we can actually get to this goal.
So let's take the president's goal at face value for a minute here. Clean energy, as he described it, including natural gas, nuclear, clean coal. Can we get to the goal? Do you think we can get to it? 80% of our electricity generated from those sources by 2035. Is it doable?
Oh, it's technically, absolutely, completely feasible to do. Now, that's a narrowly framed sentence. Mm-hmm. It is technically feasible. Whether or not we have the will, whether or not we're willing to accept the challenge as a country is a different story.
What would it take technically to get to this goal?
Well, first of all, it is a very large effort. Let's suppose, just to calibrate our listeners, we now use in the United States on average about 450, 500 or so billion watts of power. That's the average United States electricity load.
All the time?
Night,
you mean like right now, any moment?
The average load. The peak is about a trillion watts. But averaged over the year, if you took the ups and downs, the average would work out about 450 billion watts or so. A nuclear power plant puts out 1 billion watts. If you wanted to do this all with nuclear power and just get the average, you would need to build 450 nuclear power plants. We have about 100. So you would need to build 350 new nuclear power plants over the next 25 years to meet this goal. That's one every 2 weeks, starting today until we're done. Now, that doesn't mean you can't do that technically.
Right.
It does mean that there would have to be a real commitment and rethinking to how we would do this. Now, the same thing holds for solar panels. You would need something like hundreds of thousands of solar panels installed every day to meet that goal. You would need to build 1 million windmills. None of these solutions are little easy things like changing a few light bulbs. All of them are significant efforts. At the same time, if we don't do that, we are stuck where we are now. And so the question really is, I think, one of commitment and courage. You know, do we have the courage to actually meet the future and take hold of it? Or are we going to let other countries like China, like India, like Europe be the ones that are manufacturing these windmills and solar cells that we're going to then use and then replace our dangerous dependence on foreign oil with a dangerous dependence on foreign solar cells?
Let's put the courage question out there on the table to sit for a minute. But what would it take then? When you said 1 million windmills, that's if it was all to be from wind power, or is that as one element? And what you described in nuclear plants, it seems, you know, unimaginable that we'll kick one out every couple of days or weeks, whatever it was you said, starting right now for all these years. But in the aggregate, the way you define technically, I now see, okay, it could be done. But in the aggregate, do we have an achievable goal for American, technology / politics here?
We have a stretch goal. It is not technically impossible, but it will involve a commitment on behalf of our country to really take this challenge and do something about it. Every president for the last 30 years has said we have an energy problem. President Bush said we are addicted to oil. And when you're addicted, at least you should try to go to rehab. We haven't done anything.
So lay out what it might look like if we, you know, a reasonable agenda for meeting this stretch goal. How many new nuclear plants? How many windmills? How many what to make it happen?
Well, if you have a mix, which is the credible scenario, then if you want to have a mix with everything, if you had equal parts, and there are really three big cards to play. There is if we can clean up coal successfully, then you would be looking at a typical coal-fired power plant, might be 300 megawatts, 200 megawatts. And so we'd need something like a few hundred, 500 clean coal plants put online. You'd need 100 or so, 200 nuclear power plants put online, and you would need hundreds of thousands of windmills and lots of area, more than half our rooftop equivalents worth of solar panels somewhere. That would be what a mix would look like. And you could adjust those cards a little bit here and there. But if you took one of them off the table, if you said, I'm not going to do clean coal, you have to make it up with the other two. If you say, I'm not going to do nuclear, you have to make it up with the other one. The arithmetic doesn't change. It's just a question of how you want to juggle the numbers in terms of what is needed in order to meet our energy demand. Now, that being said, there is one other card. That is that if we actually used less energy, we wouldn't have to build as much of this stuff. So if we paid attention to energy efficiency, we might lower these numbers by something like 20%, 30%, maybe even optimistically a factor of two. It's still a very large challenge to make supply meet demand, but it is made much easier if we actually use energy more efficiently.
You know, I'm all for the goal. I'm a little staggered by the numbers you're laying out here in terms of what that would take to achieve. We're going to come back and dive into how this could roll out. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about President Obama's big energy pledge to America. 80% of our electricity, our power from clean energy by 2035. We're looking at what that really means, what that would really take, with Nathan Lewis, professor of chemistry at the California Institute of Technology, director of the Department of Energy's Innovation Hub there, the Joint Center for Artificial Photosynthesis. President Obama talked about the Caltech Center, among others, in his State of the Union address.
At the California Institute of Technology, they're developing a way to turn sunlight and water into fuel for our cars. At Oak Ridge National Laboratory, they're using supercomputers to get a lot more power out of our nuclear facilities. With more research and incentives, we can break our dependence on oil with biofuels and become the first country to have 1 million electric vehicles on the road by 2015.
Big goals, big challenges. Nate Lewis says, yes, we can do it, but it will take a lot. We'll look at that, turning sunlight and water into fuel. Love it if we could do that, but we've got a lot of feedback here, Nate. Here's from Charles online. He says, I'm from Kentucky. My brother-in-law, who works in the coal industry, says, I have to say that including coal in a clean energy formula will not work. Come and look at what used to be our mountains. Try eating our mercury-poisoned fish. Clean coal is decades away. Let me hold that one right there and get a call from Mike in Holden, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air.
Well, first of all, I suppose most of my thoughts would mirror that of your guest. But this country has had an energy problem since I was a little boy in the 70s and has never been able to get its act together. It's not an engineering issue. It is a political and special interest issue. I mean, I've lived in Massachusetts nearly all of my adult life. And for years now, they've been someone trying to get wind power off of the Cape. They've been entirely unable to do that. That which is probably the least environmentally impact of all the energies that can be generated. And that still isn't going. So without the federal government literally taking a proactive role in this matter, it's never going to happen. It's been administration after administration. You know, we're going on 40 years, more than 40 years.
Yeah, Mike, we hear it, and yet the stakes keep growing, and there's an awful lot of people who would like or think they would like to see it happen. Nate Lewis, help us grapple with this, about pulling the political and the engineering challenges together here. We're going to talk more about that later in the hour, but how do we get enough up and in the works that we can reach or get close to this goal?
So I think you need three things to do this. You need political will, first and foremost. You need technology, And then you need capital, because in energy, you've got to build a lot of stuff to get all of those windmills or all those nuclear power plants or whatever you're doing to get energy to where people need it whenever they want it. And you have to have all three. And so we do absolutely need a national energy policy. If you want to permit a new electrical generation facility, there's hundreds of public utilities commissions all across our country with representatives that most people have never heard their names of. They have no idea who they are. And they all answer to their own drummers in terms of what they want to do with their municipality's power supply, mostly trying to keep the short-term rates as low as possible, serving their communities in that stewardship mode. And you can't go to market if you're a new technology trying to sell to hundreds of different communities with hundreds of different individual agendas. So we do have to make a market, and you can't do that unless you have a strategy that you execute at the national level that is coherent. Because even if you said, we're going to do all renewables, well, the people in the South are going to say, we don't have much wind and we don't have much sun. We can't do that.
In the South,
we need
sun,
to do something
else.
If they don't have
sun.
They don't have as much sun as you do in the Midwest, or in the Southwest, rather. And even the sun does have the problem. For instance, we had a rather big snowstorm, if you didn't notice.
Yeah, and we wanted heat when it was on.
And think about all those solar panels that would have been blacked out by covered with white snow for days at a time that we would have had to rely on if that were our only energy supply.
Professor
this
Lewis,
is why you need a mix.
Yeah, but I want to leave our listeners with a sense of what this would take so they can have it. They may not agree with your view entirely, but they can have a view of how we would accomplish this. If you were, you know, energy king between now and 2035, and you were to lay out a program, a combination of government policy and implementation, you know, energy production facilities on the ground, what would that policy, what would that implementation look like? What would the main pieces of it be?
The first thing is you've got to do energy efficiency. We've got to save energy using technology so that we have a same quality of life and save money, and we have to do that starting today. Number one goal is get that job done.
Okay.
Number two, we have to have a mix of whether we can clean up coal, and so we need to explore that technically and see whether or not it can be done. If it can't be done because of, as the person that either raised the point before said, environmental reasons and or because you can't bury the CO2 with integrity for a sufficiently long time and be confident about that, we have to move on. We have to call a spade and say, this works. Technically, we're ready to go, or it doesn't work.
How soon do you think we could know that if we went all out at it?
We'd know it within 10 years
pretty
well.
Okay.
But the problem with clean coal right now is our federal government's policy is called Future Gen. And the problem with Future Gen is the word future in its name. It's got to be present gen, not future gen.
Get that out. All right.
Get these online.
But,
get them up and running.
But nail that down one way. It'll work or it won't, and decide that. What else? Keep going.
Nuclear? Call a spade a spade. Either have a commitment to bring nuclear in the mix when you're talking about a few hundred nuclear power plants over the next 25 years, or just fold. We can talk about 10 or 20 nuclear power plants, but it's not close to what you would need to really make the difference.
Would you bring it in as a scientist who also, I'm hearing, cares about the environment? Would you bring nuclear in the hundreds into this equation?
It's a tough call. It's a tough call because right now we have no federal waste repository, and so we have nowhere to put the waste with integrity.
You're energy king, so you get to decide. And as you say, we have to make decisions and move here. So what is it, yes or no?
Oh, sure. Solve the waste problem technically and bring on 100 nuclear power plants or 200 nuclear power plants, because I think if you don't do that and play that card, life gets extremely difficult in meeting this challenge.
Okay,
so I would play that card.
Keep going then. Here on Facebook, Sarah says, more solar power. If we could spend a fraction of the money that goes to war on huge solar panels, we could be free from coal plants and oil. What about wind and solar in this equation?
And the third big card is exactly what Sarah says, which is the sun. So more energy from the sun hits the Earth in 1 hour than all the energy consumed on our planet in an entire year. This is not a law of politics. Mm-hmm. Like, this is a law of physics, and it's not going to be repealed. So we need to call that spade a spade and decide that we're going to play these big cards, which is some wind and a lot of solar. We can do this technically, and this is why we need these energy innovation hubs, because we do have to lower the cost. And we think that that is possible if we develop good old American know-how to lead in that race to make solar panels as cheap as coal, as cheap as nuclear, and, of course, we need to find a way to bring on storage also. So I would play those three cards, either call coal a spade and yes or no and fold on it. You decide on policy if you're going to build 100 or 200 nuclear power plants, and then fill in with renewables at a significantly large scale with mostly solar as well as with some wind. And that's got to be the mix, because that's what the laws of physics say is the only things that really add up to our demand.
Okay, I want to look at what that solar might mean and your research, but take us back for 1 second here. If coal gets taken off the table, if we cannot technically accomplish really clean coal, if that's off, what does that mean? And what if nuclear is also off? What if Americans, we heard the reservations in your voice, what if they say we're just not willing to live next to nuclear waste, we don't know what to do with it, that's off. If you take one or two of those away, what does it mean for meeting this goal?
Then the big cards are some wind and lots of solar power. And we can still do that technically, too. There's no technical reason we couldn't do it. But we would have to do everything we know how to do now and do some things that we don't know how to do now just in time, so when we get them is when we need them.
What would that look like, that solar profile? If we lean that heavily on it and it was to include that kind of breakthrough face, what would it look like?
It would probably be 80% of our electricity is roughly everybody's roof. So if everybody made their roof a solar roof in our country, we'd be there.
With existing technology, or is that counting on breakthroughs as well?
It would count on some breakthroughs in cost so that we could deploy things, and it counts on a breakthrough in storage, because he that cannot store shall not have power after four is the poem of the day.
Let's go to Beth in Earhart, South Carolina. Beth, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
There's a basic question that needs to be addressed, I think, that I've not heard mentioned yet,
mm-hmm.
and that is the status of our old power grid. It needs to be updated in order to spread the power more efficiently. From what I understand, the current status of our power grid is so old that we're losing power through it alone.
The power grid, let's pick it up. Nate Lewis, how about it? How big a factor is that? We've heard a lot about it over the years.
So the grid is important. It's especially important if we're going to move towards a system that either has a lot of distributed generation where you don't need so much grid and so we shouldn't be investing so much. If everybody has their own solar panels on their roof, you don't necessarily need as much of the grid. But if you're getting a lot of renewables from wind in the Midwest, we've got to get it to the East Coast in the daytime. And so there you definitely need to rethink how we do the grid. Now, that being said, we actually don't lose much power now in the grid. In fact, 8% of the total power that's generated is lost in the grid. And that's because the grid evolved with time to make the generation sources relatively close to the population centers. But if you looked at a map of our grid, you would see basically a chicken nest worth of wires and straggling power lines all over the place that nobody really understands how it works. Otherwise, we would be able to really prevent blackouts from propagating. So it's no question that if you want to do this, you've got to bring on the enabling infrastructure to redo the grid. But in fact, that's probably the easier technical part in cost compared to actually bringing on the generation sources that the grid will need to support.
Talk to us about scientific breakthroughs. There's been, you know, sort of maybe wishful, maybe not, thinking for years now about some amazing rescue that would come in the form of some great new technological scientific breakthrough. What about on that front? And what about your simulated photosynthesis research in particular? What role could that play?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, I think that we have to get serious. You could say, well, there's never been a really breakthrough in energy since nuclear power in 1950, but in fact, we haven't even tried. When the price of oil was $8 a barrel, nobody cared.
Sure.
We spent, you know, we spend hardly a pittance on energy R&D compared to healthcare R&D. As an industry, the dog food industry spends more on R&D than the electric utility industry does. So we're not even trying right now. We're in the minor leagues. Now, let's suppose we wanted to play ball in the big leagues and really devote effort to doing innovation mm-hmm. in energy technology, mm-hmm. which we absolutely should do.
Surely it's about time for that.
Surely we can go and graduate to the major leagues, because if we don't, China and India and other countries are, and then we've lost that game right at the first inning. So we're going to do this, and to do it, we need to be working on key things that we really don't know how to do well now. We really don't know how to make cheap, effective batteries. And if we did, we wouldn't have a problem with electric vehicles having range. So we've got to call mm-hmm. A spade there and really work on battery technology. We don't really know how to bury carbon dioxide under the ground technically. We've got to work on understanding the fate and transport of those reservoirs. We don't really know how to build a next generation of nuclear power plant. So we've got to work on reactor modeling and simulation, because right now, if you built it tomorrow, it would take 40 years for the NRC to permit one of a new design to be safe for the public.
What about light-induced?
We don't have 40 years.
What about light-induced electron transfer reactions, artificial simulated photosynthesis? I guess what's the potential there?
And then, if we could find a way to take the biggest energy source we have, the sun, and not only capture and convert it, but store it, the missing gap, into the most energy-dense materials that we know about, which are liquid fuels, you would have a silver bullet that would permeate not only electricity, but fuel and energy independence and environmental security all in one fell swoop.
Who knows how to do that?
So we actually do know how to do that. We actually, collectively, in the lab, after 30 years, have the ability to take the sun and with pieces made out of things like semiconductors that you would see in solar panels, mm-hmm. but on the nanoscale, we can put together systems that are better at converting sunlight into fuel than the best plant has ever been, by a factors of 5 or 10 even.
Better than leaves on trees, better than wheat in the field, better than all that.
We know how to do this. So why don't we have it today? Well, you want to do 3 things. You want it to be cheap, you want it to be efficient, and you want it to last. And right now, we can give you any 2, but not the 3rd. If it's cheap and efficient, it doesn't last. If it's cheap and last, it isn't efficient. And if it's efficient and lasts, it's not cheap.
What would it look like if you achieved it? Would our cars be covered in leaves, our houses covered in bushes, silicon bushes? I don't know.
No,
how would it work?
Airplanes don't have feathers, but once you know birds fly, you know how to do it better. So it would probably be inspired, but not look like a leaf. It's going to be something probably like bubble wrap, and you'd roll it out. Sunlight would go in, water vapor from the air would go in along with carbon dioxide, and then out would come either out the sides a gaseous fuel like hydrogen or a liquid fuel like methanol or gasoline. And then you take that liquid fuel and fill up your water heater equivalent with your tank, power your house, fill up your car, run your factories. Now, the solar density is such that you might be able to power your home, but if you start to make all your load, you're going to need larger areas than that. So there will definitely be industrial scale facilities that are going to look like refineries with these things around them. But we absolutely know how to do this now. It's a question of whether we can bring to bear the challenge to do it in the future.
Didn't you just get $100 million or something like that to work on this, if I got that right?
And we're going full steam ahead to get it done.
I'm I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Obama's big energy pledge to America. 80% of our electricity, our power, from clean energy by the year 2035. What that really means, what that will really take. Nathan Lewis has been my guest from Pasadena, California. He is director of the Department of Energy's Innovation Hub at the California Institute of Technology, the Joint Center for Artificial Photosynthesis we're learning about today. President Obama talked about it in his speech. Of course, there is big energy research going on right across this country. MIT in our backyard, Oak Ridge, the president mentioned, and in many other sites as well. But this, if we're going to make it, as Nate Lewis is laying it out, is urgent. We've got to go fast, big, and deep. We've got decisions to make and technology to develop. In just a moment, we're going to turn to the politics of this. But, Nate, lots of response online here. And here's one from Ashley on Facebook, says 2035 is too far away. And another here from Jane who says, let's talk turkey about climate now. The roof is coming down around our heads. We can't wait until 2030, she says. What about the time? What about the, you know, the time factor the president's laid out here? Is it reasonable when you put it up against climate change?
Well, this is an important point, that climate change is something that nature is taking care of, whether or not we decide to pay attention or not. It is happening, in the sense that we know that humans are emitting carbon dioxide into the air every time we step on the gas pedal and burn some coal and natural gas. That's a law of chemistry. And we know we're taking those carbon dioxide levels to a place that no human will have ever experienced. We also know it's going to last for a time scale of 3,000 years, comparable to modern human history. So we absolutely, if that's a problem that you don't feel warm and fuzzy about leaving to your grandchildren and their kids, do something about it starting now. That being said, the energy industry is an enormous industry, and it's unrealistic to expect that you could poof, wave a magic wand, and with 3 or 5 years, take over $1 trillion of capital investment and turn it around in 5 years. That's not going to happen. And so sooner is better than later, and later, like 2050, is by this measure too late. And so actually, the president's goal of something in the neighborhood of 2030 or 2035 is probably the right balance between just in enough time and getting it done realistically while not being too late.
Let's get a call from New York to Poister, New York. Sheila, you're on the air, Sheila.
Hi. I was wondering, with a lot of the especially with wind and solar and some of the stuff that you've been talking about, vapor and even algae, there's a complaint about, oh, we can't waste subsidies on that, let it rise and fall with capitalism. But isn't research and making things like nuclear and natural gas and clean coal, aren't they going to need a lot of money from the government? And my question is, what makes subsidies for one acceptable and one not? Is it regional? Is it fear by the people who already get a lot of government money? I've never understood that part of it.
Sheila, thank you. Nate, what about where government money is going in terms of research and development here, and how we decide that, where we put it? Is your lab the right place? How do you justify that?
All right. Well, on the subsidies on the consumer-facing side, that's not a law of physics, that's laws of politics. Mm-hmm. That depends on how effective your consortium of party representatives are at bringing home the bacon for whatever their local favorites are. So I can't get into that morass. But I can say that the only way to make clean energy cheap is to innovate in order to bring it down. There's no law that says that solar has to be more expensive with wind than coal. It's just that we've got to do technology development to get it to be as cheap so you don't have to pay more and you can have your cake and eat it too. That's exactly why we have these hubs. In our hub, the Energy Innovation Hub, a partnership at Caltech and Lawrence Berkeley Labs, we're going to have almost 200 people. And they're going to be from all walks of the science life and engineering, chemical engineers, mechanical engineers, basic chemists and physicists, with one goal. Our goal is to develop methods to take the sun and directly make fuel for our cars to meet the president's challenge. And we're going to live and breathe that goal and do nothing else until we get there. Now, why do you need a hub? Why don't you do this in 200 separate places?
Or do it in the private sector.
or in the private sector. The reason is that the risk is too high for the private sector right now, since it's not something that you can commercialize. And so we have to develop the proof that it can be done in a form that can be commercialized. And there are certain things that we can only do with a collection of people in one place. Like, we have a way, instead of discovering one compound every week, of screening a million compounds every single day. We're going to build the world's highest throughput capability for discovery, and it's going to be right in your backyard, and we're going to be able to change the way that scientists actually discover catalysts. We can only do this in a hub. This is why we need to bring these people together to work on these problems.
I'm going to go to the politics in just 1 minute here, but one more question on this front, and a big question. I mean, you've described the gravity of what we're looking at here. You sound confident about your research, but given what a big challenge we're up against, how much of the answer do you think, if you're funded as you need to be funded, can come from solar and the kind of research that you're doing on simulated photosynthesis? How much can you bring to the table?
Well, we wouldn't be playing in the game if we didn't think that we could make a difference. So we are completely optimistic that on some time scale that we're going to do something that's going to really change people's lives. That being said, it would be foolish to put all your eggs in one basket because this problem is too important to let failure even be an option. So we've got to be doing this all across our country. We've got to get every smart kid who wants to do something about improving our world working on the science and technology and energy innovation. My kids in my group, I call them my kids, my graduate students and postdocs are some of the smartest, best people on this planet, and we got to let them go do this, and we got to do this in every corner of our country because we want to turn them loose with good old American innovation and know-how so we can lead in this quest and not sit back on our hands.
Professor Lewis, please stand by there in Pasadena. You've laid out a lot for us, and it is riveting. I want to look at the politics for a moment. Stephen Mufson joins us from Washington, energy correspondent for The Washington Post. Stephen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
You've been listening to the kind of agenda that Nate Lewis is laying out for what it would take to accomplish the president's goal. You know the politics of this very well in Washington. How well aligned are the politics to swing in behind this kind of vision? And you've heard these are enormous numbers. These are big changes required to swing in behind this and get it done. Are we anywhere in the ballpark? Is there some coalescing consensus or not at all?
Well, I hate to sound like a pessimist, but I think the answer is sort of not at all. I mean, I think there's a central issue here, and especially given where technology is today, and that is to get individuals and investors and companies to choose to take measures toward energy efficiency and to choose the most energy-efficient technologies. We're going to have to raise the price of fossil fuels somehow. And because right now it really doesn't make economic sense for, you know, it will someday, and it makes more and more sense all the time. But still, to get the kind of change that everyone's talking about is going to require faster action, and that's going to require getting the incentives right. And right now they aren't there. And the prospects for doing that in Congress are pretty dim. You see people like Senator Lamar Alexander, who says, you know, we can't build an economy that's going to compete globally with expensive energy, that cheap energy has been essential to our economic development. And that's very much at odds with what a lot of people who are primarily concerned with climate and energy think, and that's the basic deadlock here.
And, of course, just in the last few days, Republicans, again, going at the Environmental Protection Agency, the power that it was given to bring in some regulation on the energy side. We've got some tape here from Republican Congressman Fred Upton of Michigan, new chairman of the House's, Republican chairman of the House's Energy and Commerce Committee, unveiled a draft legislation yesterday to prohibit the EPA from regulating greenhouse gases. There's a little bit from an interview with the American Enterprise Institute last month here where he's expressing strong concern that over-regulating, as he says, industry could hurt a fragile American economy.
I am one of the all-of-the-above guys. I support drilling in the Arctic. I support renewables. I support nuclear power, clean coal technology, all of those things. But if you tie a hand behind our back and really impose such burdensome regulations on the industry that they're going to not be able to produce the energy. Mm-hmm. You know, we've lost 1 in 5 manufacturing jobs across the country the last 3 years.
Nathan Lewis in California, you hear Stephen Lufson describing Senator Lamar Alexander saying we need cheap energy for industry in this country. You hear Fred Upton there. He's the chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee. What are you thinking about this 2035 goal as you hear those positions?
Well, I think that we have to decide as a country whether the wind has changed directions here globally, whether or not China and India are going to lead in this future or the United States is going to lead and supposed to follow. We've got to understand where our future is. Is our future in the energy of the past cheap for a while, or is our future in the energy of the future cheap and abundant, clean energy that is actually sustainable? The bottom line is when the wind changes direction, there are those who build walls and those who build windmills. What are we going to do?
Let's get a call from Boston. David, I think this is David Cash on the air. David Cash, thanks very much for calling. You're, Undersecretary for Policy for State Energy and Environment in Massachusetts, David?
Exactly right. And Nathan's last point, I really want to build on with the optimism that we can get to 80% by 2035. Definitely a resounding yes from Governor Patrick's administration, when it's already happening here. And, we find it kind of interesting, these arguments about cheap energy. We currently spend in this state $22 billion a year on energy that goes out of this region. Those are maybe supporting jobs in Russia for natural gas or Saudi Arabia for petroleum, but not here. As an economic development...
I mean, we spend that money in Massachusetts, you're saying, on imported energy from elsewhere.
Exactly. I mean, New England, I'm calling from New England, obviously. We're at the end of the energy pipeline, both figuratively and literally.
Why are you optimistic when we see the kind of political profile confronting this that Stephen Mufson's just described from Washington?
Because we have a huge amount of R&D resources, technological know-how, and when it comes down to it, I think we do have the political will. We've just completed a clean energy and climate plan that was required by state statute here, overwhelmingly supported, and we are on path to get a 25% reduction in greenhouse gases by 2020, below 1990 levels, and building jobs.
You're one state. What do you need at the federal level to really go whole hog here on reaching these big goals?
Several of the points that have been raised, we obviously need the kinds of incentives and regulatory structure that can help build the markets. We need the support for R&D to let things really explode. I mean, we're fortunate enough here to have that in this state, but we need to get the kind of regulatory structure and market to unleash the private sector to address that. And that's happened here. We've seen a 20-fold increase in solar power in the last 3 or 4 years, from 3.5 megawatts to 70 megawatts. And that means jobs, installation jobs, electricians, plumbers, architects, engineers, manufacturing jobs in this state. And that's all moving in the right direction.
When we hear it, you're fired up, and I wonder if we could do it state by state. David Cash, thank you very much for calling. Stephen Mufson, what about a state by state answer or rising to this challenge?
Well, I do think that the battle is moving to the state level because of the gridlock here in Washington. And a lot of interesting things are happening at the state level. They have much more ambitious targets that are already passed into law for renewable energy standards, especially in the state of California, as well as others. And so I do think a lot of the fight is moving to that level, and that a lot of people who want to promote renewable energy see more possibilities there.
Stephen Mufson, energy correspondent with the Washington Post. Stephen, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Nathan Lewis, we've got a couple of minutes left here, and we really want to think about the most important messages we can get from you at the heart of this. You've mentioned several times China, India, what's going on overseas. Is it a neck-and-neck kind of race here on the research front? Historically, Americans picture themselves as out front on research, science innovation.
I think in energy innovation, that's still correct. We are still proudly willing to say that we're still leading the world in innovation, in development, and we have the opportunity, if we keep it up, to be the next country that has the Google, that has the Apple, that has the Microsoft of energy, because that's where we're good. We're good at training our students and postdocs and our technical scientists and engineers at being innovative at discovering and changing our world to the benefit of everybody. On the other hand, other countries are dead serious about this. When we started our Center for Artificial Photosynthesis, within months, we now hear that there are similar centers with the explicit goal of catching up and passing us in those technologies in Japan, in China, coming up in India. So we are running a race that we are ahead, but if we misstep, we got a lot of people running right next to us who are determined to surpass us. And the worst thing that we could do would be to start this and then decide that we don't want to fund some of these hubs or cut back their budget, because then we will have started off our competition in a way that they will overtake what we started.
Is this ultimately going to be decided, success or failure, or something in between here, in your labs or in Washington?
Both. We need the labs to do their job that they're good at doing. I think nobody can deny that people are really good at innovating in our country. And we've got a track record of doing that. And actually, I think the people in Washington have to have the courage to bet on the American people, to bet on our ability to come through when our country needs us. We're going to deliver on our end, guaranteed, if we get the ability to do it. And that's up to people in Washington.
Listeners, there's just one great glimpse of what lies behind and in front of the president's big State of the Union pledge on clean energy. 80% of electricity from clean energy by 2035, he says. Not easy. Big challenge. Big competition. Nathan Lewis says we can do it, but we can't step back. Professor Lewis, thank you very much for being with us today. Really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for your time and insights.
You're welcome.
Nathan Lewis, director of the Department of Energy's Innovation Hub at the California Institute of Technology, the joint center there for artificial photosynthesis. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And when you go to Facebook, hit that like button and become a fan. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.